No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show that will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to join in the conversation and call in with questions at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype them to us at BBS Radio. Hello, Maria.
Hello, Senator.
We've missed a couple weeks because of July the 4th and other things, but it's nice to be back.
We have a great guest
tonight. We have Professor Stephen Rogers, who is a distinguished professor. He's taught all over the world. He's retired from Harvard Business School, and he's taught in Africa, Australia, Canada, Germany, Hong Kong, India, Mexico, the Philippines, and Vienna, Austria. It would be easier to tell you where he hadn't taught than to tell you where he has taught. He's completed 5 triathlons, so he is my personal hero, of course, and he's part owner of the Chicago Sky in the WNBA. Professor Rogers, thanks for being on the show and welcome.
Senator Brown, thank you very much for having me, and thank you very much as well. Ms. Sanchez, it's my absolute pleasure, and I'm speaking to you from Chicago.
Well, we love Chicago. My daughter lives in Chicago. She went to DePaul University, graduated from DePaul, and never left the city. She loves it so much. So,
and my father was born and raised in Chicago. So he's first generation. His folks came through Ellis Island, so he had the real immigrant experience back in those days. And a Golden Glove boxer. So the stories that he used to tell about Chicago, I wonder how many of them are still true. Because they spoke English as their second language. So there was the German neighborhood and the Italian neighborhood and the Polish neighborhood and the Irish neighborhood. And it sounded like it was vibrant, and talk about diversity.
It is here. It is Chicago is the city of neighborhoods, and I absolutely love it. And the only other city I would ever live in the United States other than Chicago is Washington, D.C.
Well, we appreciate that, Professor Rogers. And you know, I am unfortunately a trash talker, so let's get this out of the way. The Washington Mystics in overtime last night beat the Chicago Sky. But I should point out the Chicago Sky is higher up on the ladder. They're number 2 in the East Coast Conference, and our girls are number 4. So it was a great victory for us.
Yes, it was disappointing for us going into the Olympic break, but we're optimistic, and I'm glad to be speaking to someone who knows what's going on with the WNBA. You know, I'm the father of 2 daughters. I was an original investor in the Chicago Sky WNBA team. I believe in supporting women's sports and professional sports. Neither one of my daughters are adults now, but despite them being adults and being women now, no longer engaged in college and high school sports, I'm still a strong advocate. And one of my favorite things is being a part owner of the WNBA Chicago Sky.
Nice.
Oh, that it's so cool. And can I tell you, I went to the University of Maryland, and my wife and I, every year, my wife was head of the Alumni Association for her school, and we would get tickets to 1 men's basketball game and 1 woman's basketball game. You could not get tickets to a men's Maryland basketball team, but a game. but the women were one of the top college teams in America, and we would go to the games, and not even half the stadium would be full, and we just couldn't understand it. They were so entertaining, and they were so good. So
and athletic.
Yeah, and athletic, you know, and we just, you know, I'm glad that we have support here for the Washington Mystics, and I hope it's the same in Chicago for the Sky.
Yeah, well, we're getting there, and we're hopeful of following in the footsteps of the with the Mystics with winning a championship in the immediate future. So, and I'm with you around disappointing with the absence of support for women's sports, but
yeah,
the key is for us to all do our part, and then to keep speaking positively about the great athleticism and the great brilliance of these women who are partaking of these sporting events.
Yeah, and it's a different game, isn't it? I mean, it seems to me that when I watch women play, they have more finesse. It's not as much of a pass. I find it very entertaining, and I hope that they get more and more sponsorship as we go forward in the future, because they really are great athletes. Let's start by talking about your book. Your latest book talks about the wealth disparity between white and black America. Can you give us a brief outline of what that exactly is these days?
And the title, A Letter to My White Friends and Colleagues, What You Can Do Right Now to Help the Black Community.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maria, thank you very much for adding that fact. And this is a book, as Ms. Sanchez said, that's titled A Letter to My White Friends and Colleagues, What You Can Do Now to Help the Black Community. The book was released, the publisher is Wiley. The book was released on May 25th, the first year anniversary, the 1 year anniversary of George Floyd's murder. And the book basically says that the primary reason behind black and white challenges in America is anchored with the wealth disparity, that the civil unrest, the protests, and all the other things that we see and have seen throughout history are just symptoms of the bigger problem between blacks and whites, and that the primary reason behind the black and white challenges is the wealth disparity. And that wealth disparity is the difference in the net worth between blacks and whites. And when we talk about net worth, we're talking about assets minus one's liabilities. We're not talking about your annual compensation. We're talking about what you own. Your assets minus your liabilities give you your net worth. And so what we know is, in America, the average net worth of a white family is over $170,000, compared to the average net worth of a black family, it being only $17,000. So we see a 10 times difference in the net worth of whites versus blacks. And my book very specifically points out the reason for that disparity. It's not because whites have worked harder. It's not because whites have saved more. It's because of what has happened to blacks as well as whites in this country, and specifically what was done by the federal and state governments to enrich whites, while at the same time what was done by the federal and state governments specifically to impoverish blacks. And when we look at this wealth disparity today, what we see is that the federal government, with sanctioning 246 years of enslavement of black people, followed by 60 years of black codes by states, followed by 40 years of redlining. These things were done intentionally, and you see them in documents. They were done intentionally to enrich whites, while at the same time they were done intentionally to impoverish blacks. So these things that happened, that created this wealth disparity, have resulted, quite frankly, in high success. That what was done was intentional by the federal government, the state government, and it resulted in this wealth disparity, which has been a problem for America ever since 1619.
So you make a really interesting and compelling point about that, and I think the average person can understand that slavery kept black people behind white people because it was free labor, and that was over two centuries or 200 years. And then you mentioned the 60 years, but I don't think people might understand the implications of what you meant by redlining. And if you would please let our listeners know what that means, because they might not know, and actually how that did keep black communities impoverished because of what redlining did to them?
Great. Thank you very much for asking that question. Redlining, after the Second World War, the federal government said that we want to create in America a middle class. Prior to the Second World War, there was no middle class in America. For the most part, for example, there was no such thing as 30-year mortgages. There were only five-year mortgages. And therefore, if it was only five-year mortgages, the only people who could get mortgages to buy homes were wealthy people. And what we know is the foundation of wealth creation begins with real estate ownership. But most Americans couldn't own a home because they couldn't get a mortgage that was lengthy enough and had long enough terms that would allow them to pay it off. So the federal government stepped in, and our federal government said, we want to create a middle class. We were very intentional with this with the New Deal. We want to create a middle class. And so what they said was they created a housing association called the Federal Housing Administration. And the Federal Housing Administration, FHA, went to banks and they said to commercial lenders, they said to banks, if you give mortgages that are 30 years in terms and duration, we will guarantee 90% of that mortgage, such that if that person defaults on the mortgage, you, the bank, will only have 10% at risk. So when banks got that guarantee by the federal government, banks flourished and made extraordinary profits because banks, one of the most profitable securities by a bank is a mortgage, and banks flooded communities with mortgages. And one community, for example, that was flooded was the Italian community, as we talk about, and I want to talk about the impact of this on immigrants. But the Italian community was flooded with mortgages by the Bank of Italy. And the Bank of Italy was created because Italians were at one time discriminated against. But they were not discriminated against by the federal government in writing. So the federal government said, we're going to guarantee these mortgages. And they said, we're going to determine who gets the guarantee based on who lives in certain communities. And the communities were rated A, B, C, or D. An A community was considered a low-risk community, which was synonymous with being white, and a D community was considered a high-risk community, which was not just simply synonymous with being black or occupied by blacks, in the words of the federal government, occupied by Negroes. They literally said in the document, communities inhabited by Negroes or communities close to where Negroes live will not get this mortgage guarantee. Therefore, what happened was banks flooded their American communities with these mortgages that were guaranteed by the federal government. But those same federal government mortgages that were backed by the federal government were not being given to black people simply because they were black. Black banks could not participate in the program either. And the result was you had communities like Levittown in New York. That's the first suburb ever created in America. And Levittown, New York, was created by the Levitt family. And with this, the advent of these new mortgage guarantees, the Levitt family, they went to their banker and they said, we want to build this community outside of New York. And they built 17,000 homes. And the bank went to the federal government and said, can you give us a guarantee on the development loan we're going to give to the Levitt family to build these 17,000 homes? The federal government said, yes. So the Levitt family built 17,000 homes. The condition by the federal government was that these homes would never be occupied, in the words of the documents, would never be occupied by a Negro. So those 17,000 homes only were sold to whites. The most ironic thing was that a white person who had been a prisoner of war in Germany could actually come to America, get one of these mortgages that was guaranteed by the federal government in Levittown, but a black person who had served in the military with the United States could not get such a mortgage guarantee. So Levittown prospered. GIs came back from the Second World War. Some of them were using the GI Bill. Veterans came back from the Second World War. Some of the GIs were able to get homes in Levittown for as little as $800. And those homes today are worth over $500,000. But again, blacks were left out of that market. They could not partake of the acquisition of homes because of that. A group in California wanted to do exactly the same thing that they had done in Levittown, New York. And it was a family of 400 families members in a co-op, and they bought this land outside of Stanford University. And they went to a bank and they said, we want to do just like they did in Levittown. We want to build a community of single-family homes on this new land that we bought. So they went to the bank. They asked the bank to get a guarantee by the federal government. The federal government denied that request because out of those 400 family members, three of them were Negroes, in the words of the document. And so that co-op of 400 families went back to the bank, and the federal government said, suppose we agree that no more than three black people will ever be occupied in this community. Again, the federal government said, no, we will not give mortgage guarantees for that property. Therefore, the bank would not give the loan to that cooperative because the bank would therefore have 100% at risk. And so the co-op had to sell the land. They sold the land to a white developer who agreed to all of the government's requirements in terms of excluding black people, and the land ended up being developed. So what you had was this growth in the middle class that was intentionally created by the federal government, and it was intentionally decided by the federal government that they're not going to give any kind of support to black people. The result of that was today what we see is, for example, less than 40% of black families own homes. The black community has home ownership at the lowest rate of any racial or ethnic group in this country. The only way that black people could buy homes up until 1968, when this was deemed illegal, the only way that black people could buy homes for the most part was this gray market that got created. Because black people could not get mortgages from the banks that were federally guaranteed, what you had was a gray market created by basically white business people primarily, bright businessmen who would buy homes in the black community, and then they would sell them to black people for upwards of 32 times their original cost. They would charge them interest rates that were today considered usury, some obscene interest rates. And the result was, in Chicago, for example, in the 1950s, 85% of black people who purchased homes via what they call contract buying. And they were buying these homes under contract. So they were paying inflated interest rates. They were paying inflated prices for the homes. And research today shows that black people, as a result of buying on contract, paid on average $500 extra a month for their mortgages. And by the time they finished paying off their entire mortgage, they had paid an additional $71,000 for their homes. My grandparents, who came up from Louisiana to Chicago, my grandfather worked in a steel mill, had a great, well-paying job that would have qualified them to get a mortgage, but because they were black, they could not get a mortgage. So my grandparents bought a home under contract under those terms. They were one of the people in the 85% that I just mentioned. And it took them 4 years before they can get a mortgage with a financial institution. And that financial institution that gave them the mortgage was Sears Roebuck and Company. So what you see, though, is in terms of redlining in particular, what you see is you see this wealth being denied to black people. In essence, what you see conversely is wealth being created for white people and the government subsidizing it. It's almost a socialist program for white people, while at the same time it was a program designed to bankrupt black people. And it was successful in doing that. I'll close with this, and that is I did a similar interview with my alma mater, Williams College. And there were about 200 alums on the Zoom session. And afterwards, one of my classmates, one of the alums, and 90% of the people there on the Zoom session, they were white classmates. And one of the alums reached out to me. She said, Steve, I always knew about redlining, but she said, I thought it was just the private sector that did that to the black community. She said, I never knew that the federal government actually did that to black people. And I said, that's one of the things that we need to do right now, and that is disclose the truth about what actually happened. And in my book, the book is chock full of research, data, analysis. It is not a book that's just with a letter associated with it. It is intended to educate. While at Harvard, I taught entrepreneurial finance, and I created a new course called Black Business Leaders and Entrepreneurship. So it's a melding of research and facts about finance and black history and history that negatively affected blacks that was primarily done by the federal government and state governments.
Well, what can we do, Professor Rogers? What can the federal government do to change this paradigm? We know that there have been many government programs. Lots of them have failed. Busing, for example, or giving. In D.C., we give you extra points if you want a government contract in your Black-owned business. But unfortunately, a study a few years ago showed that the vast majority of those contracts weren't actually going to Black-owned businesses. We had a law, for example, that 10% of all construction projects had to be, those contracts had to be given to Black businesses, but they weren't being given to Black businesses. There was a public interest group did a study showing that either the government failed in their responsibility to enforce that provision, or people were figuring out ways to get around it. So what, give us an idea of what a good government program might be that would help mitigate against the things you talked about in redlining. Is there one?
Well, absolutely. And again, these were things that were done intentionally to harm Black people, and I believe the government has an obligation to intentionally redress those actions that they took with the intentionality of hurting Black people financially. And so in my book, you know, I recommend things that individuals can do. I give four recommendations, three of which that I recommend for private citizens. The first is that they ask people to donate 9.29% of their annual philanthropic dollars to historically Black colleges and universities. And the 9.29%, Senator and Ms. Sanchez, comes from the 9 minutes and 29 seconds that Officer Chauvin had his knee on George Floyd's neck. And so I asked them to donate 9.29% to HBCUs. And HBCUs are extraordinarily important to America. Historically, Black colleges and universities, they were created in the 1850s because Blacks were denied admission to white universities, despite the fact we were taxpayers. And what we know today is there's 101 HBCUs, and there's 300,000 Black students at HBCUs. And 76% of those students receive Pell Grants, which means they come from impoverished families, family households of $25,000 or less. The average endowment for those schools is a mere $12 million. And if those schools did not exist today, I believe that less than half of the 300,000 students would even be in school, because predominantly white institutions would not be interested in enrolling all of those poverty-stricken students who come from poverty-stricken homes. So I asked white citizens to make donations to HBCUs. I asked them, secondly, to spend 9.29% of their annual budget with Black-owned businesses. And the reason is because Black-owned businesses are the largest private employer of Black people in the country. So if you want to help the Black community, if you spend money with a Black-owned business like I do, over 50% of my annual budget goes to Black-owned businesses. My dermatologist firm is Black-owned. My accounting firm is Black-owned, so forth and so on. But when you do that, you create jobs for other Black people so that they can take care of themselves. And if people take care of themselves, if they become self-sufficient, we know that self-sufficient people can live in healthy communities.
So,
third thing that I ask people to do is to deposit money in Black-owned banks, 9.29% of at least your annual savings going to a Black-owned banks, because what we know that Black-owned banks will send money to the Black community. We know that Black-owned banks, 70% of their mortgages go to Black people, whereas less than 0.5% of mortgages by white-owned banks go to Black people. So those are all things that the private sector can do. The public sector and the federal government in particular, and this is my fourth recommendation, it doesn't matter, Ms. Sanchez, it doesn't matter, Senator Brown, how much money Black people save. It doesn't matter how much we do business with Black-owned business. We will never be able to close that wealth gap unless something dramatically is done by the federal government, and that is financial reparations. So in my book, I recommend that the federal government give reparations to Black people, and that they do it the same as the federal government gave reparations to over 900 white slave owners when slavery ended. They gave 900 slave owners reparations to the tune of $300 per slave person that they had. I do it because there's precedent for America doing that with Japanese Americans. They interned them during the Second World War, 120,000 of them. Under President Reagan, a bill was passed giving reparations to the tune of $20,000 to each of 80,000 Japanese who had been interned for 3 years. I do it because there's international precedent for it as well, with the United Kingdom giving reparations. You know, in 1843, slavery was abolished by the United Kingdom, Britain, and in all of their colonies. And what the country did was they took out debt financing to give reparations to the slave owners. And they took out specifically debt to the tune of 20 million pounds in 1843. And they gave slave owners reparations for the loss of the assets of the people that they enslaved. That's $20 million today is about 16 billion pounds. And the debt was just paid off by the UK. The final debt was paid off in 2015. So I'm asking America to step up and give reparations to black people who are the descendants of blacks who were enslaved for 246 years, because there's nothing that we can do to ever close this wealth gap, because that 246-year of slavery, that was one hell of a head start. One person said, it's better to have a head start than it is to run fast. And that's exactly what happened with white Americans. They got a head start from our federal government, such that one scholar said that if we stop white wealth creation right now, it would take blacks over 225 years to catch up. And the reason for that, if you think about it, is pretty close to that 246 years of enslavement. And as one activist said, she said, slavery with blacks was sort of like black people and white people playing the game of Monopoly, where every time the black person won the game, they actually had to give their winnings to their white opponent. And so for 12 generations, there was no transference of wealth that went to black people. Conversely, there was transference of wealth that went to white folks. And so the only way to right this wrong and get this wealth disparity closed is for the federal government to give reparations to blacks. There was an attempt by the federal government to do something similar, to make some kind of amend at the end of the Civil War. And as you well know, General William Sherman, he was marching through, heading the Union Army, and he was marching through Savannah, Georgia, as they had defeated the Confederates. And General Sherman, as he was marching through Savannah, Georgia, blacks were leaving the plantations, saying we're getting out of, we're leaving slavery, and he started following the general along with all of the Union troops. And General Sherman sent a letter to President Lincoln. He said, these people are following us, what should I do with them? And President Lincoln sent him a letter back, and this is the quote. President Lincoln said, ask the Negroes, what do they want? So General Sherman met with 20 black clergymen. 20 black clergymen, some had been enslaved, some were always free men. And he asked them, he said, and he met with them in this sort of five-star hotel in Savannah, Georgia in 1865. And he asked them, he said, what do you want at when you're free? They said, we want land. He said, okay, and where do you want the land? Do you want it amongst whites or do you want it separately? Now, this was not unanimous. Some of them said, we want it amongst whites because we want to just integrate into the community. But the majority of them said, we want it separate. And they said, we want it separate because we can't trust that whites will always treat us fairly. So after that meeting, General Sherman and Lincoln, they passed Special Order Number 15. And Special Order Number 15 was a government act that said that 400,000 acres of land that had been owned by the Confederates, soldiers in the Confederacy, were being taken from the Confederates, and the Confederates now, who had been defeated, they were to be tried for treason, and many of them were to be hung, hanged. And so, and they said in Special Order 15, they're going to give land to blacks, the new freedmen, to families in plots of 40 acres at a cost of $1.25 an acre and 40% down. And 40,000 acres had actually been allocated to blacks, the new freedmen. And then Lincoln gets murdered. Andrew Johnson replaces him as the vice president, replaced the assassinated President Lincoln, and Vice President Andrew Johnson rescinds everything. He says, quote, unquote, Negroes are not entitled to receive this. This is unfair to white men. He rescinds it. He takes the 40,000 acres back from whites. He gives it back to the Confederates, who now only thing they have to do is apologize for what they did. And after that, they were pardoned. And that was the only effort on the part of the government to give reparations to blacks, and that didn't succeed. So my recommendation, I'll close with this, is that the federal government should give to approximately 20 million blacks who are descendants of those who were enslaved, who are 18 years and older, that would be 20 million blacks who fit into that category, a check that is the difference between white wealth and black wealth. So that difference is approximately $153,000, which would just simply be about seven times what Japanese Americans rightfully got for the 3 years of their internment. So it would be a cost of $153,000, one check that would go to approximately 20 million black people, 18 years or over. The cost would be approximately $3 trillion, which would be $1 trillion less than what the federal government paid to bail out the banks. Our annual economy is about $21 trillion, so we can afford this. And I believe that that would be the true effort to begin the healing process of what happened to blacks and what happened to America in terms of the greatest sin imposed on Americans in this country.
Well, you know, I'm proud to say, before I let Marie ask another brilliant question, I'm proud to say that Marie and I had the leading expert on reparations, supposedly, a professor from Duke University, on our show, and we talked about this. Yes, I think there's a lot to be said in what you're, or a lot to be considered in what you're saying. But let me ask you something about HBCUs, since it's I have been a co-sponsor of the Thurgood Marshall Foundation dinner for many years. And as you may know, the Thurgood Marshall Foundation, the whole purpose of it is to give money to HBCUs. But one of the problems that they tell me they have with historically black colleges and universities, many of which we have here in the Washington area, we have five or six of them. In fact, UDC is the oldest of all of them, is that they have problems getting enrollment now that all universities are open to black people. They have a lot of people want to go to Harvard or Yale or Georgetown or GW or some other college. So is there something else? Is there another element that besides funding that needs to happen for HBCUs, for example?
You know, I think that's an outstanding question. And what we're seeing now is we're seeing a resurgence in interest in HBCUs by blacks. You just read that Hannah Nicole Jones has just signed on to become a tenured professor at Howard University. We're starting to see prominent athletes make the decision to forsake scholarships at other schools, predominantly white schools, and go to HBCUs. And to your question, in terms of the recruitment, I believe that the root cause of any problems that HBCUs have lies in the fact that they are poverty-stricken schools. They can't offer the same kind of scholarships, financial aid, that a predominantly white school can offer. And so that's why part of the choice is sometimes to go to a predominantly white school, because of the financial wherewithal that's available to students at HBCUs. Despite that fact, I cited, there's 101 HBCUs that have 300,000 black students. When I retired from Harvard Business School in 2019, I did a tour of 10 HBCUs because I wanted to teach black students the same content that I was teaching wealthy white students. So I did a tour of 12 HBCUs. It was supposed to be 12, only because COVID kicked in. And I went to the small HBCUs, including Bennett Bennett College in North Carolina, an all-female school, which has a small enrollment. But it is my position that they have a small enrollment because they can't offer financial aid. And these schools have historically catered to people who come from impoverished families. I went to Bennett College in North Carolina. I also went to Stillman College in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Again, a nice, small, beautiful school a mile away from the University of Alabama. And then I went to the big ones, Howard University in Washington, D.C., Morgan State in Maryland. And so I traveled and I visited these schools. And what the common denominator is, as I stated earlier, 70-plus percent of the students at these schools qualify for Pell Grants. And so the schools are fighting against, and what we've historically seen is the predominantly white schools have been able to recruit the black students who have the greatest academic backgrounds and everything because they've been able to offer more to them. And I believe, and that's why I'm recommending that people make donations to HBCUs, just like Mackenzie Scott did last year. She donated over $560 million to HBCUs. You know, she was the co-founder of Amazon, and she donated over $560 million to HBCUs. Oh. And, you know, the ideal is that there should not be a need for HBCUs. Well, you know, there shouldn't be a need, ideally, for women colleges as well, because they could theoretically matriculate at just the co-ed universities. Well, but that is not always the best solution for people right now. And as I stated earlier, predominantly white institutions are not going to take over 50% of the black students at HBCUs today because they're poor. And I'll close with this, and that is, we know the importance of HBCUs historically in the sense that they were created because white universities would not accept black students. But we know that HBCUs, like Lincoln University and outside of Philadelphia, that's the alma mater of Thurgood Marshall. We know that Dr. King is alum of HBCU, Morehouse. But also in the present day, we know that 80% of all black judges today attended an HBCU. That 50% of all black lawyers today attended an HBCU. 50% of all black doctors today attended an HBCU. 40% of all black engineers today attended HBCU. And 100% of American vice presidents,
female vice presidents.
Yeah. And I'll really close with this point. Most HBCUs, and this is the theme of my book, I'm asking white to help blacks get out of our situation now. Help us privately and help us with a letter to the government asking the government to support reparations. Most HBCUs were actually founded by whites. I'm asking whites to follow in the footsteps of their ancestors by giving back to the black community. You know, Spelman College, the name Spelman is the middle name of the Rockefeller's daughter. Morehouse College was founded by, and most HBCUs were founded by white religious organizations. Morehouse College was one of those, and Morehouse was the name of the secretary of that religious organization. Howard University is the name of a former Union general. So most HBCUs were founded, and they're extremely important to the black community, and they're extremely important to the American economy and America's success.
And Maria, I'm really glad that you, thank you, Michael, that you brought up Mackenzie Scott, because she gave gifts of $40 million and $45 million to more than several universities. I think the lowest was $5 million. But then something I didn't know was the Netflix co-founder and his wife gave $120 million last year to HBCU and the United Negro College Fund. So there is movement, and I'm so happy to hear about that because, again, you're asking people to walk the walk and talk the talk. And now you've piqued my interest because 9.29% to black banks and 9.29% to black owned businesses, other than our own circles that we do business with already, like you mentioned, some of your physicians, how do we find out that information so that we can do just that?
Super question. First of all, my book, when I wrote the book, it's chock full of facts, research, data, but also I realized I needed to do more with this book being a call to action. I'm asking people to do things. So I needed to do some of the heavy lifting. This book needed to include some of the heavy lifting. So to your point, Ms. Sanchez, the book that speaks about spending at least 9.29% of your annual budget with black-owned businesses, in the chapter about that, we identify how to find black-owned businesses in your city.
Okay, great.
The book, in the chapter about HBCUs, we identify all of the HBCUs, and then we tell you how to go to their philanthropic department, their department that accepts donations. And finally, in the book, we also identify all of the black banks and tell you how to contact them. And then we actually give you a template for the letter to write to your congressman or congresswoman imploring them to support
Nice.
It is embedded in the book. That information that you just asked is in that book, in the book.
A letter to my white friends and colleagues, which I understand is number one on Amazon.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, so I think Maria just answered my next question, which is how you get the book. You go on Amazon. But let me also ask you, I want to touch on this. We don't have enough time to fully discuss this, but the last guest that we had on the show, Professor, was Verda Tedeth. You may have heard she was a high school student that received a $40,000 scholarship to Harvard, and she gave it to less fortunate people that wanted to go to community college. We just thought it was such a great act of altruism. So I want to know, what do we need to train white people? What about critical race theory? This is the big, you know, this is the 800-pound gorilla in the room that everybody's talking about right now. Do we need to teach critical race theory to people so that they understand the things that you're talking about? I think I was just flabbergasted when I heard a white congressman say that critical race theory makes our founding fathers look like racists. Well, I really don't understand how you can look at a group of men, as great as they were, who were slave owners, and not understand that they were racist, because I think that in itself qualifies you, does it not?
Well, you nailed the nail on the head. And the reality is, we just have to be honest and we have to be truthful about what happened. And in terms of critical race theory, I just call it history. And I think when one wants to exclude certain things out of the true history of what actually happened, that's not history. That's propaganda. That's something akin to the slave Bibles. You know, there was a time when religious organizations as well as slave owners, because they knew that slaves were believers of God and Christians, that they had to change the Bible. So they literally, if there's a thing called the slave Bibles, they literally tore out the pages of Bibles and printed new Bibles that were slave Bibles that had chapters in there about people not being a slave and the story about the exodus of slaves and everything. Those things were, and that's propaganda. That's what we're talking about right now when people say let's not teach these things because it tells and it paints people as racist. Well, over 55% of the people who approved the Constitution own slaves. I don't think there's anything worse than owning another human being. And let's just put that as a fact. And so I believe that you have to tell the story. When I attended Williams College, little small liberal arts college, my major, I'm 64 years old. My major was history with a concentration in black history. So I knew these things because it was taught to me. And in my classes and some of my classes, there were white classmates. I am emphatic that it is imperative that whites know the history of this country and not just an edited version, that they know the history. And as a result of knowing the history, which I try to convey in my book, that is, again, full of history to tell the story around happy. Once you know the history, I think that will help you change maybe some of the ways that you've been thinking about how you've been fortunate. And maybe it will help you, and I say this about my book. My book is aimed at those people who have a kind heart and a logical mind. If you have a logical mind and you understand and you're being taught history and the facts, then hopefully that will touch your heart to try to do something to improve things. And so your question is one that says, should they be taught? We absolutely must teach them. The Tulsa Massacre, which has been beautifully publicized this year, celebrating its 100 year, recognizing its 100 year celebration. So a lot of whites have, first of all, for the first time, heard about the Tulsa Massacre now. But 3 years ago, the Tulsa Massacre was advertised here in Chicago on a news show. And after the news show on NBC News show, they did a survey of the audience. 96% of whites never heard of it before. That is not good. That is not good for our citizenry, for them, for a large population of our citizenry, not to have any knowledge about that. I believe whites should be expected to learn black history or history of America that includes what happens to black. I believe part of our immigration questions should have to do with black history so that new people who come understand what happened to blacks and what happened to this country. And so I am fully supportive of what you've recommended. I think my book is a good place for people to start. And I'd like to close with an answer to your question around what the government can do. I spoke about preparations, but let me give you a couple of other things that I would recommend. And that is, I believe the government should have a policy that says that no state and federal taxes are given are issued for interest earned on deposits in black-owned banks. That those who choose to put money in a black-owned bank, the interest that they earn is tax-free. I believe that the federal government can give full deductions for donations made to HBCUs. And if you don't want to make it specifically for HBCUs, how about the schools that have students, 50% or more of the students qualify for Pell Grants, that those donations get 100% full donations. And so we start finding ways to encourage people to do the things that I've asked them to do. But to your point, I think it's absolutely imperative that whites and other non-blacks learn black history and know what's going on. I'll close really with this. At Harvard Business School, I created a new course called Black Business Leaders and Entrepreneurship. And I created this course because Harvard Business School had 10,000 case studies that we published. And, you know, we make over $150 million a year selling case studies around the world to other business schools. 80% of the case studies used by other business schools throughout the entire world come from Harvard Business School. So we had a library of 10,000 case studies, and only like less than 100 of them had a black protagonist in there. So we were teaching our students that black people didn't matter. We had 300 case studies that were being taught to our students in the first year that's mandatory, and only one of those case studies had a black businessman or businesswoman in it. So to that point right there, whites were not learning, and whites in our Harvard Business School and non-whites were learning that black business people don't exist, that they don't matter. So we were basically being erased out of it. Now, I'm happy to tell you Harvard is now reversing that. And in fact, one of the case studies that they just introduced as mandatory is about Tulsa Massacre, which talks about reparations. So what you had was the absence of content about blacks and what has happened to us in almost every phase. And the result of that is people have this idea that blacks are in the position that we're in, that we're an impoverished race because we didn't work as hard as someone else. Well, the reality is white wealth was subsidized. It was literally subsidized by the federal government and redlining. And people need to learn those facts. And someone can say, well, that's divisive. Well, the reality is we're divided right now, and we need to be able to come together around the facts. And once we come together around the facts of what's happened, that will be the way that we can become closer together. We don't come closer together by embracing propaganda.
Maria, do you have a last word? We're running out of time here.
I know. And maybe you can give just a quick answer, Professor Rogers. And thank you so much for your time and your expertise. What do you think about the phraseology woke and stay woke? And should whites be using those terms?
You know, that's a great question, Ms. Sanchez. I'm 64 years old, and when I created my course, Black Business Leaders and Entrepreneurship, you know, we had to write a description for the course that was public. So the students in all of the Harvard schools, the Harvard Business School, as well as the other 13 Harvard schools, would, if they wanted to, they could cross-register for the course. And my, I have two daughters. My oldest daughter is 39. My youngest daughter is 35. My youngest daughter said, "Dad, put in your description something about woke." And Ms. Sanchez, I said, "What does that mean?" So it was generational. I was clueless. She said, "No, put it in there." Something. She gave me the wording to put in that description about being woke and all of that kind of stuff. And so I am, and this, and to that spirit, I did put it in there. And one thing I am is, I'm always willing to embrace lifelong learning. And so if there's a phrase that is appropriate to be used that connects me to another generation that allows me to somehow educate, provide educational, I support it. And as far as I'm concerned, if you, for example, do what I recommend, two or three of those things that I recommend, then you can say, "Listen, here's evidence that I'm woke. I have $250,000 in a black-owned bank. Here's other evidence that I'm woke." But just using the words to show that you are cool, I think that's where the problem lies.
Okay.
But once you doing like McKinsey Scott is woke, woke, woke.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's a great place to leave it, Professor Rogers. Thanks so much for being with us
today. And your passion is powerful.
Yeah, and you know, we hope that we can have another discussion about this in the future. I also hope that the next time you visit Howard University, you'll look me up so I can take you to lunch, because I think you're fascinating. And I think that you're really committed to this. And this is really, these are really issues that we need to come together on to move America forward. I truly believe that. So thank you again for being with us. You know, at the end of the show, every week we leave with a song that we dedicate to our guest. And tonight's song is by Sly and the Family Stone, one of my favorite everyday people, because that's what we should all be. And this goes out to Professor Rogers, and it also goes out to my oldest friend in the world, Rick Relling, who unfortunately passed away last week. So, everyday people, Professor Rogers.
The stuff that I'm professing is bipartisan. My Republican friends have embraced this and actually taken some of the action that I've recommended. So I'll close with that. This has been my absolute pleasure. Thank you, Ms. Sanchez. Thank you, Senator Brown.
Thank you.
I love Sly and Family Stone. You're woke.
All right. Thank you. All right. We'll see you next week. Maria?
Thank you to our listeners. We really appreciate your loyalty. And continued success, Professor Rogers.
Thank you. The same to you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. All right.